Okay, so if you came late and have to pick up your homework, make sure to pick it up by the time when you're leaving, and then I'll take these back. I will post the solutions for homework 2 are already online. So if you go to the homeworks page, there's the solutions available. And those are the ones that were used as the master solutions to grade this one. The solutions for homework 3 will be posted today or tomorrow, one of these days. And so you will have the solutions, but you may not have corrected the graded homework 3 back in time for the exam. Okay, that's, I mentioned that earlier. So, but you should still check, look at the solutions and make sure that you understood what is supposed to be done. Okay. So a couple of people have asked for possibility of changing the date for the midterm. It doesn't matter to me, so I came up with 3 choices, and we'll just take a vote right now, and we'll either stick to the date or we'll change. So one is, as we expected, Tuesday. The other is the Thursday, which is next Thursday instead of next Tuesday. The third, I think, is deem and pass. We just deem and assume we all pass the midterm. But I like it. I think you don't also have to do anything. Presumably, I'm not allowed for the third version. So Tuesday versus Thursday, is there any serious, we'll just take as a show of hands, people who want to stick to Tuesday. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. What? It doesn't matter. You are supposed to be here in the class time. I'm very sorry. Okay. So it's like, I may decide not to change it, but
on Wednesday we had some other
study. You're supposed to be studying all through the semester for the exam. So if you are studying the day before the exam, you are sunk anyway. I can tell you that. I'm not saying that I'm changing, but so 7 people wanted to take it as Tuesday. You know, if you, how many people want to shift it to Thursday? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Okay. I'll send you a mail if I shift it to Thursday. Okay. I guess that still doesn't add up to the number of people in the class. So the rest actually would rather not have an exam, which is fine, I think. Okay. To me, it's the same. And also, actually, I don't quite understand. Studying is, I thought, always monotonic. So if you are prepared by Tuesday, why won't you be prepared by Thursday?
We always want to revise on Wednesday, just to make sure.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I would have thought, I mean, that if you are ready by Tuesday, you would also be ready by Thursday.
I'm ready even now, but I would like
that's to great. That's great. Okay, I understand. So, okay, that's where we are. So it's like 7 to 12 is what we counted, right? Is that the number I counted, 7 to 12? Okay. That's still only 19. A huge number of people don't want exams. Are they not here? Yes.
Where was the
I sent a link.
Okay.
I sent a link. Do people, I mean, I know that a lot of you guys downloaded it. I also know that you did the path ascendancy crawling, right? So you're clearly not crawling much. By the way, that is called trawling, not crawling, you know, looking for solutions, looking for, you know, midterms available. But I sent a note. So if you missed it, you can just look at the mail archive. Class mail archive will have all the mails sent to the class. So that would be the easiest way to look at it. Okay, so that's are there any questions? Okay, so we are, today I'm going to complete the discussion on MapReduce and start talking about clustering. Clustering actually is the third project, the part 3 of the project. There are a bunch of things, a couple of things that we require you to add and a couple of things that you can decide to add. And clustering is one of those topics, for example, for the project. Okay, but anyway, so we were talking about the Google data, the server farms, and how it would be useful to have a kind of parallelism where essentially each machine can be off doing its own small thing, and then every once in a while they have to come together without having any shared memory. And so I was just about to say that, well, MapReduce is this form of parallelism which is good for certain types of tasks. Okay, it's not a panacea for every possible task being speeded up, but if you have to do the same thing for multiple pieces of the data, then you know MapReduce winds up being a useful abstraction. And then, so let me just talk a little about what MapReduce is and how, for example, we can do MapReduce based MapReduce based architecture for distributed indexing. And one of the things, one of the cottage industries right now is to take many different algorithms, many different tasks, and write a MapReduce architecture for them, MapReduce code for them. And in fact, I think I'm just running right now this AAAI AI and Web Track, and there's like one paper there about MapReduce for hierarchical agglomerative clustering, which we will be talking about. Hierarchical agglomerative clustering we'll be talking about next class, next lecture in clustering. And so they were doing MapReduce architecture for that. Okay, so there's a lot of interest in writing those because there is direct support for MapReduce kind of computations. So let's get an idea for that. So how many of you know Lisp? Okay, so basically this comes from functional programming. You know, Lisp currently definitely has this idea called map and reduce. Both of those are functions. So for example, here is a little function which says map 1+. 1+ is increment function. Okay, map this function 1+ onto all these arguments. Okay, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, the moment you do that, you will get basically it's almost like 1+ is being applied in parallel to all of these guys. Okay, so then this will become 5, this will become 6, this will become 7, and so on. The reduce, on the other hand, takes a list and reduces it into, I mean, basically works on the entire list and gives a single number out. Okay, so for example, here, I'm reducing this list with the multiplication operation. That basically means I'm going to just successively multiply 5 times, 6 times, 7 times, 89, 8 times, 9 times, 10. Okay, so that's map reduce. Okay, so map basically does the parallel, the same procedure parallelly on a bunch of arguments. Okay, reduce takes the results and then converts it into, it sort of consolidates. Okay, here is another example, primality testing. Suppose I have a bunch of numbers and I want to count how many prime numbers are there in that list of numbers. Okay, suppose I have written a little function called primality testing, which basically gives me 1 if the number is a prime number and 0 if the number is a non-prime number. Okay, so then what I can do is I'll just map the primality test onto all the numbers parallelly, and then so I'll get a list of ones and zeros. Then I reduce them by plus. I will know the number of prime numbers. You see what I'm saying? So this is MapReduce architecture essentially. Okay, and this is the MapReduce computation. Now, in terms of MapReduce architecture, the basic idea, so first of all, the idea is that each of these map operations will be done by separate machines. So imagine each primality testing is being given to a separate computational node. It'll be given the number, it will run the primality test on that node. Okay, so previously here when we had parallelism of primality testing on each of these numbers, you would assume sort of that, you know, all of them are being done parallelly by the same CPU, which means CPU is going to sequentialize them in some order or interleave them in some order. But if I basically have multiple CPUs and then each CPU gets one of these numbers or a couple of these numbers on which it needs to do primality test. Okay, so that's the map parallelism. So multiple machines are doing the exact same procedure but on different arguments. And then they'll communicate their results back, you know, in terms of this list of ones and zeros to a master node, which you can then do the reduce phase. Okay. So the parallelism here is that all map operations can be done in parallel. And so if you increase the number of nodes, you can all, you know, basically each node can just be doing one primality testing, for example. Okay. The overall reduce operation has to be done after the map operation is over. So it's basically sort of like, so there's a parallelism in map 1, map 2. These can be done in any order. They can be done in parallel. And then, but the reduce requires all of them to have been, the results from this entire phase is ready when you, before you reduce. Okay. Now, also the amount of parallelism you can exploit here depends on the length of the input. Because you're doing the exact same thing for each of the numbers, the more numbers there are, the more parallel, the more you can use the CPU. So for example, if I have two numbers on which I need to do primality testing and decide, oh no, my list is let's say five. That means I have five numbers and I'm trying to figure out how many of them are primal, are prime. I can't use more than five nodes. Really, there's nothing I can do in this way of doing things. If I have 10,000 CPUs, I still don't know what to do with them because each CPU gets one prime number testing. So the 9,995 have to sit around doing nothing. Okay. So as the list increases in size, the number of CPUs you can use can be increased. Okay. So it's sort of input parallelism. Okay. So that's the basic idea. I mean, in fact, there are two ways of understanding MapReduce. One, of course, after this, one is how would you take a program that you have, a task that you have, and write it as a MapReduce form, in a MapReduce form. The other is, if you're a systems person, how does one develop a system, okay, where you essentially have a master node who decides how many slave nodes to, you know, wake up, and they each do each of these map tasks. Okay, and so the deal about MapReduce, the popularity of MapReduce is basically because of both of the reasons. Okay, one is that there actually exists a reasonable architecture on which if you were to write your task into the MapReduce form, then somebody else will decide how to push the map operations to different nodes. And somebody else will decide basically the synchronization issues and so on. Okay. The fact that the kind of tasks that you have can actually be converted into MapReduce form is partly because, in fact, on the internet, I mean, on the web processing, on the, you know, information retrieval, most operations essentially are easy if the input length is small. The reason for the complexity is input is large. Do you understand what I'm saying? We are used to problems where essentially the complexity is decided in terms of the input length, right? If something is NP-hard, that means it's exponential in the size of the input. Nothing we have discussed till now has actually been exponential in the size of the input. But the problem is the input, on the other hand, is large, very, very large. So doing polynomial operation on very large input can still kill you. And that's where, you know, since we have many such operations, many such tasks, MapReduce winds up being useful. And now that MapReduce is available, people will start, you know, if you have a hammer, everything starts looking like a nail. So since you have a very good support for MapReduce parallelism, everybody tries to convert their task into something, you know, that can actually exploit the MapReduce parallelism. For example, a classic case is GPUs. You know that the graphical processor units have started becoming faster and faster and faster. And they have a certain type of parallelism in them, right? Because GPUs essentially are controlling the entire screen. Okay, they have a certain kind of parallelism. Now, some people have started saying, well, really, the GPUs in the computers are way too efficient, way too fast for just running the screen. Can we use them to do other things? And there is like a whole area now where people try to convert some other problem that you need to solve into a form that GPUs can do very well on. the same situation here. If you have MapReduce formalism, and if you have an architecture for it, then you will try to convert every problem you have into a MapReduce problem. Okay? So that's the basic idea. So now, one of the things that I want to discuss today is at least give you one non-trivial example. This is obviously, not a text processing example. So I want to give you the example on text processing, index construction. But there are a bunch of other, page rank computation, for many other things, for like, as I just said, hierarchical agglomerative clustering. Many of the processing that's done in text processing right now are written as a MapReduce task. Okay. Here is another way of looking at, so this one sort of looks in terms of, the general MapReduce abstraction of Lisp. And this is more suited to actually what is implemented in the MapReduce architectures. So the assumption is that you start with the data that you have is a bunch of attributes and their values. A large number of attributes and their values. Each mapper takes each of these and spits out essentially another set of attributes and their values. Okay, and a reducer basically takes, so there's an A here, there is an A here, so it'll add up, there's a 1 here, there's a 5 here. So basically you are merging all the A's here. A has 1 and 5, B has 2 here, 7 here, C has 2, 9 and 8. And now you can reduce, and this, for example, suppose these were the K1, K2, etc. Let's say these are documents with terms. So if you have a document, each term, keyword K1, and it appeared once. So K1, 1, K2, 1, K3, 1, and so on. So a document is just a set of words and and they're occurring in the document. So each word occurs once, you have the word name, 1, word name, 1, and so on. You don't have to write the zeros because there are many, many words that are not occurring in the document. You don't need to talk about that. And the mapper, essentially what it's going to do is it's going to convert it into in terms of the terms, each term that you're interested in, and the number of times it's occurring. And then here you are adding up the term occurrences in the document, for example. Okay. We'll again look at an indexing example in a minute, but so this is more likely the way you would see if you were to look for, I'll give you some more citations for MapReduce architecture for those of you who are more into systems and want to actually write, want to understand more about MapReduce. I'll give you some other references, but if you look at them, they will describe it more in this form. Okay. So here is, for example, a case. So here, what you're doing in this case is you're counting the words, number of words, and the mapper essentially takes the documents, and for each term in the document, the mapper is going to emit term count 1, just like I said, the name of the term and 1 number, number 1. Okay. The reducer is going to take the term T and the list of counts that it has and then adds them up. Okay, now notice one of the things that wasn't obvious previously is here it looked as if there is no parallelism in the reduce, right? Because for this particular problem, I'm only counting the number of primes. But I could actually change this. For example, I want to count the number of multiples of 2, multiples of 3, and multiples of 4 in a big list of numbers. Now, instead of primality testing, I would actually write a little function called, multiple checking, which will give, if it is a multiple of 2, it will give 1 number, multiple of 3, it will say 1, and so on, okay? And then the reduce will add up all the multiples of 2s together, all the multiples of 3s together, all the multiples of 4s together, and then tell you how many numbers in this list are multiples of 2, how many are multiples of 3, and so on, okay? So reduce also can be parallelized. The only important thing, only bottleneck is between the map and the reduce, things have to stop. So basically, after all the mapping is done, then you do the reducing. Okay, so sequentiality is in that. Okay, so that's the thing. So you get the mapper all parallelism in the mapper, then you sort the results and then you do a reduced phase. If that works, then you can basically, if you can think of the task that you're trying to run as in this kind of a parallelism, then the advantage is you can write a pseudocode almost like this, and somebody else, essentially Jeff Dean and his friend, essentially will decide how to dynamically allocate CPUs to your computation. Okay, so under the hood, to support this kind of an abstraction, under the hood there should be a large amount of support for actually, you know, keeping track of what are the ideal CPUs, which ones are available, and then you then assign them, and then when they are done, you need to synchronize the results and you need to send the thing to back to reduce. Okay, that you don't have to do. All you need to, you the user, essentially need to only understand this, that this is the mapping and reducing parts are important. And if you can write your task that way, then you're in good shape. Okay. Now, not all tasks basically work for, well for this kind of a parallelism. But the interesting thing is, for much of the tasks in text processing on the web, you wind up doing the exact same computation to many, many entities. That's why it's a useful thing. Okay. So here is an example, a slightly more involved example of doing an indexing. Okay. Remember, we need to compute the inverted index. And so you have, now, inverted index computation is not exactly the kind of thing that people will discuss in the, you know, algorithms course, you know, combinatorics and intractability, because it's not an intractable problem. Okay. It's not exponential in the size of the input. It's just the number of documents you have is a huge number, and then they will have very large vocabulary, and then you need to consider all the number of instances of each word across all the documents, and you know, in computing the inverted index. Okay, and so what you would basically do, and in fact we mentioned this last, you know, I think I mentioned this in passing, probably. At the time we talked about indexing, but I'm going to mention it again just now because you'll have slightly different understanding of it. Okay, so the version here, basically you'll assume you have two kinds of operations, parsers and inverters. So the parsers are basically doing, you know, looking at the document and emitting the term once, term one more, so each term and the occurrence of that term, that's what they're emitting out. Okay, and the inverters will essentially count the number of times the number of places where those terms actually appeared. Okay, so these, who becomes master, who becomes parsers, and who becomes inverters, that's decided automatically by the MapReduce. Okay, what you need to do is essentially write your computation such that a parser node does one thing, an inverter node does one thing, and there are a bunch of parser nodes you need, the bunch of inverter nodes you need, and the number you need depends on the amount of documents you have to run. Okay, so the parser, in this case, master assigns, so the idea is you have a, let me show you the picture. So you have a whole bunch of documents, right, and you need an inverted index in the end. So the idea is you will take the documents, make them into splits. So documents 1 to 100, 100 to 200, 200 to 300. Each split is given to a separate parser unit. Okay, and they pretty much do the exact same thing. They're all doing parallelly, looking at other, you know, this guy is looking at first 100 documents, this guy is looking at next 100 documents, and so on. So they can do it faster than one guy looking at all of them. Okay, and what do they need to do? They essentially need to, each parser essentially needs to compute, you know, what terms are there in those documents. It has to parse the terms, and then if there is a term starting with letter A, puts it in this, you know, so it basically splits them into the terms starting with letter A to F, terms starting with letter G to P, Q to Z, for example. Okay, so all the parsers are doing is counting, basically emitting this term occurrence pairs, okay, and then grouping them into buckets, different buckets, A to F, G to P, and Q to Z. Okay, you can increase this. It's a different, you know, basically you can split them into, you know, smaller regions. That's not important. Okay, so now once each of, so basically all of these are working parallelly, so they don't need to talk to each other because this guy is only counting documents from that split, and this guy is only counting documents from that split, nothing else. So they don't need any synchronization. And what they're doing is they're writing into this. Once this is written, then essentially the inverters, what they have to do is this guy is going to look at A to F from every one of these segments. And for each of these terms, it knows where it is occurring, how many times it's occurring. So it can then invert that and write the postings file. Okay? So you essentially converted a invert index construction into something that could benefit by large number of machines doing the identical computation. All of these are doing parsing computation, all of these are doing the inverting computation. And each computation is simple, it's just that there's a huge amount of data to deal with. Okay? So again, parser reads a document at a time and emits term and document. This term is in document D1, this term is in document D2, etc. That's what it is. It's not the number. What we need really is, we're not counting terms. We are actually trying to decide how many, which terms are in which document, right? So parser will say Rao D1, Rao D2. Okay, that means Rao exists in D1, D2, Rao also exists in D7, Tom exists in D1, and so on. This is what it's writing out. Okay? And then now the inverting basically means, so remember that when you are writing this, as soon as you see the document D1, you know whether or not that word is there. This is a forward. Inverting essentially says, if I know across all the splits, so Rao, for example, will occur in this bucket, right, everywhere. Okay, there'll be a whole bunch of Raos here, a whole bunch of Raos here, a whole bunch of Raos here. Okay, let me say, for example, these three are the only Raos that exist across all these splits. There's one Rao here, one Rao here, one Rao here. Okay, now inverted index essentially just says whenever I need Rao, it's present in D1, D2, D7. That's the postings file. That's what inverted index tells you, right? Given the word, where which documents contain it. Okay, now, so that's what he said here. Parser writes the terms into the partitions, and then inverter collects the term document first, and then writes one posting per term. That's it. Okay. Again, normally people look for parallelism for hard problems. You know, I think up to the time you came here, it may well have been the case that the problems that you thought were essentially hard in the size of the input. You know, input would be small and the problem would be exponential time in the size of the input. Much of the work in text processing is the processing itself is cheap. It's the input is very, very large. Okay? And for those kinds of things, MapReduce is a very useful abstraction. Okay? So that's, you know, this is basically an example of MapReduce. And then, in fact, this one, I won't go into this, but this is basically how you can specify this particular splitting of parsers and inverters to a MapReduce architecture. Okay, it's a high-level support, and then somebody else then decides how many machines to give. Okay, as I said, there are other. If you are into this, the part that I completely ignored is what happens after I give the specification. That would be more of an operating systems issue. In fact, Jeff Dean, who got I think NAE membership and all sorts of awards, Jeff Dean and Sanjay Ghemawat are the guys who came up with this idea and made it happen for the Google file system. And basically, they wound up, they're all operating systems people, and they're basically talking about how to make sure that, you know, how do you keep track of the pool of machines that is available, how do you assign machines as the architecture, as the new computation starts. But if you are a Google employee, let's say, or any employee of some, you know, a company which supports MapReduce parallelism, by the, you know, in fact, Hadoop is an open source Hadoop is an open source simulator which basically can work on even a single machine or on a cluster of machines, which will simulate MapReduce for you. So if you wanted to try out how to convert your problem into a MapReduce version and see how fast it goes, then you can work on that. And in fact, there is this book that's actually freely available right now there, if you are into MapReduce. Some of you might very well be into these systems issues. You can go look up that book. It's a small 50-page book. It'll talk about both what the programmer needs to know and what the systems guy needs to know in terms of making this parallelism happen. And then you can also listen to this lecture in particular. There is a, you know, cluster computing little course, mini course available, and you can listen to that lecture, which will go into more details. Okay? That's all I'm going to say about essentially, I mean, I think I wanted you to know that there is a certain type of parallelism that is there in spades in the kind of tasks that you're doing here. And there is actually an architecture that supports that parallelism so that you don't need to do the dirty task of figuring out which particular machines are working on which particular pieces of the problem. You decide how the problem is split into parallel map phase and a parallel reduce phase. Okay, and then somebody else decides how many machines to throw in based on the input. Okay? Yes. The question? Yeah. This one. Okay.
So in this case, if the RAW is appearing in AF and GP.
No, RAW cannot appear in AF and GP. RAW can only appear in QZ. These are basically, each parser is writing out basically when you have, let's say, suppose I have a document D1 which says Rao drank coffee, and document D17 which says Rao is sleeping, right? Okay, and then a parser which looks at this document, let's say this document is appearing in split 1 and this document is appearing in split 7. Okay, the parser which looked at this document would emit Rao D1 drank D1 coffee D1. That's all it does. There's no huge programming here. Okay, and then this guy would emit Rao D17 is D17 sleeping D17. Okay, now this guy, this Rao, when it is written, it will be written in this bucket because this bucket starts from Q to Z. All the letters, all the words starting from with letters Q to Z. Okay, and then these are all the words. And so basically, suppose, so the split for the parser 1 is writing that first one in this place, and the parser 5 is writing that Rao D17 in this place. And then a reducer would be looking at all these and looking for RAVs in them and then invert them. So there is a RAV D1 and a RAV D17. So the postings file will say RAV is available in D1 and D17. Just puts a global spin on it. That's all your invert index is. Looking at a document, you clearly know. And now, by the way, if I look at this, don't you see now that this is the same exact architecture that you can use to do the connectivity server? Right? Because looking at a particular page, you know what URLs are emanating from that page. Individual parsers can basically do a little more computation, look at the document and say, well, here are the actual resolved IP numbers that are being linked to from this page. So they do some non-trivial work. For example, they might take the base URL, add this, you know, offset to it, and then get the ID, right? Now, what you need in the connectivity server is for each ID, who are all pointing to that, which is exactly inverted index. Okay, again, looking at what each of the individual machines does is disappointing because they don't seem to be doing much. But remember my analogy. What individual microarray analysis people do is disappointing. Okay, which also means many more of them, you know, with very little training can do that. And you can throw more people to get more microarrays looked at. And somebody else is then reducing their findings into some patterns. Okay? Any other question? Okay, so as I said, even now there's a cottage industry of starts trying to convert every possible task into MapReduce task, because there is support for MapReduce. Okay, and as I said, you know, there is a paper now I was just looking at hierarchical agglomerative clustering, and I'm pretty sure a whole bunch of things that are being done in search engines these days, they try to write it as a MapReduce. Okay, so it's worth finding out, you know, if you're interested in this, you know, how to write a computation into MapReduce form. Okay, this is not too different from how to write a computation into a Lisp program versus a Pascal program. You know, how do you write it as functions passing arguments versus, you know, variable value, global variable values that are being shared across computations. So you just look at the same task, but try to write in a different way. And sometimes it's possible, sometimes it's not in this particular case. When it's not possible, all that means is there's not too much parallelism, essentially. The whole thing will be one map reduce. And so there is no parallelism possible. All input is seen by a single node, then you're basically dead. Okay? Any more questions? Okay, so let's now look at clustering, which is basically a change of topic. And for the next couple of classes, we'll be talking about clustering. And so clustering, unlike MapReduce, which is a very recent topic, didn't exist actually for like last several years, clustering is a classical topic. You know, how many of you have heard about clustering algorithms before coming to this class? See, you can see now, right? Probably multiple classes may have actually covered clustering. I have to still cover it here because, you know, I know that half of the class doesn't know it. Okay, so for some of you, it's likely to be repetition. I can't help it. As I said, it's a classical topic, but I also think that in computer science, saying something classical is silly, really. Did you guys get this joke? So the entire computer science started less than 40 years back. To say something is a classical topic means it was like yesterday it started, as against this morning at 10 o'clock. But, you know, given that, you know, we're not talking about Socratic method at this point, okay? But still, so, you know, it's more older topic than MapReduce, okay? So clustering is the process of grouping similar-looking objects into groups, basically. So you have a list of things, a set of things, and you're trying to cluster them into similar-looking clusters such that basically you can see some patterns in them, for example. Okay. It's used across the board in many, many different things. Clustering is also called unsupervised learning, which is a particular form of machine learning, as against classification learning, where you're given training data, which is here are the examples, here are their labels, and then you will give test data, and then you are without labels, you are supposed to predict what their labels are based on what you learned in the training. Clustering, on the other hand, normally you are just given a bunch of entities and you are not told what their labels are. And you are supposed to figure out if there is a way of organizing them into classes. Like, for example, right now I'm looking at you guys, okay? I want to cluster you. Obviously, I can cluster you in all sorts of different ways. I can cluster you in terms of, are you guys tall versus short? Are you guys wearing checked shirts versus non-checked shirts? Are you guys a four-level student versus a five-level student? Are you guys, you know, any number of possible different ways I can cluster you? Okay, so since I'm not told what the classes are, and, you know, for example, if on the other hand, you told me that I am thinking that this class is actually made of two clusters, a four-level cluster and a five-level cluster, a 494 and a 598. And then here are six students from the four-level. here are 7 students from the 5 levels. Then here is a new student. Who do you think, which cluster do you think this student belongs? That's supervised learning, because I gave you examples of the clusters to begin with. And so then I can actually try to see what makes these things, these people 4 level, and what makes these people 5 level, and then learn a description which then I can apply to the new test case. What I'm being given is the entire class, and I'm supposed to figure out what the class, you know, what's the right clustering for this is. And that's why it's called unsupervised learning. And in the case of unsupervised learning, in fact, one of the issues we will talk about is, for supervised learning, there is something called a ground truth. Oftentimes you are told, you know, you have a whole bunch of data which is labeled, and you take part of it and give it to your learner, okay? And then you give the other part of it as a test without giving the labels and see how well the learner does. But if you have a clustering system, exactly how do you decide whether or not the clustering system is good or bad? Is it working well or not working well? Because even the guy who gave the problem doesn't have the answers. I don't know what clusters we are supposed to find. Okay, so in fact, for clustering, we will actually wind up talking about, unlike classification, where all evaluation is external evaluation. External evaluation essentially means that there is a ground truth, and if you guessed it for the test data, you get a point. If not, you don't. Okay? Right? So tomorrow, I mean, presumably this class, I would like to think, is supervised learning scenario. So I gave you lectures, I gave you homework, and then the big test is coming next week. Right? Presumably, I'm hoping that it is, you know, I would like to think that it's a supervised learning scenario, and each problem has an answer, which I just decided not to show it to you. For the homeworks and the class discussion, I gave you the problem, I gave you the answer. Okay, and so when you are done with the midterm, the only way you're going to be judged on is, did you get the answer? That's it. Okay, for example, look, I did not get the answer, but I wrote so well, my lettering is really neat. You know, do you get extra points for that? No. Because if you did get extra points because you wrote very nicely and with proper indentation plus many, many pages of it, then that would be considered internal evaluation. That means it looks good as an answer paper. It just gets all answers wrong. Okay? In the case of clustering, we will see that sometimes we don't even know what the answer is. So all you can hope for is, does it look neat enough? Okay, so for clustering, actually, we will wind up having two kinds of evaluation, external as well as internal. Because nobody really knows, you know, in a true unsupervised learning problem, you don't actually know what the answers are, what's supposed to be the clusters. Okay, so that's how it's different from normal classification learning. Now, why this is interesting for us is we are, for example, going to look at use of clustering in search engines at the minimum, okay? If I give you a whole bunch of results, right, normally I'm only being allowed to show top 10 results because beyond that you don't want to see. One interest we had was diversifying the answers so that if somebody is looking for Kamu Party, let's say, you make not only me happy but also other people who are looking for other Kamu Parties possibly happy. Okay, and to do that, one way is essentially look at all the answers, right? All the answers, cluster them. Cluster them into presumably, you know, such that each cluster corresponds to a different common body. Then provide a description of these clusters. Okay, and that will basically show that to the user, then you basically, they'll have a bunch of clusters in front of them. Whichever cluster they like, they can click on it and get more of those results. That's a great way of improving the diversity of results. And this is very important because we didn't quite know when the user gave the query which particular Kamu Party they might be looking for. When they gave the query Bush, we didn't know which kind of Bush they were looking for. Bush the president, Bush the shrub, or Bush the Kalahari Bushman, you didn't know. Okay? So presumably all the hope is that if you get the 1,000 pages in the document corpus, all of which have word Bush in them, and you try to cluster them, hopefully all the George W. Bush will be one cluster, all the George H. Bush will be another cluster, and all the Kalahari Bushmen will be another cluster somehow. In which case, then I can just show you the cluster. Okay? Now this clustering can be used either to improve the diversity of results. I can suggest to you related pages. If you like one page, I can tell you what other pages you might like, because hopefully any cluster this page is a part of, you might like those too. Okay. Then you can also basically, you know, other things like constructing a directory of all the pages in the world, automatic directory construction. And the other thing, you can also look for duplicates using this same kind of an analysis, you know, to see which things seem to be close to each other. Okay. Now, one of the issues we talked about, so if you apply clustering techniques for search engines, what you get is an improved recall, because you get to show in your top 10 results not just Subbarao Kambham Party's pages, but also other Kambham Party's pages, because each would be a cluster. Okay, so you are likely to get every user. Okay, and so it also allows disambiguation, because if you don't know which particular meaning of the term that the user is looking for, you will try all of them rather than just give one answer. Okay, here are some examples. Right now, you know, over a period of time, search engines have existed. There were several search engines which actually said they are better than the other guys like Google or currently Bing because they do clustering. So in fact, I think many of them, more or less, you don't hear too much of them, you know, because the market forces didn't work too much in their favor. Okay, but you know, for example, Clusty is a clustering search engine. Okay, I think it's still available. Which basically, if I say Jaguar, it would, instead of just showing top 10 results, it also shows here the clusters in which Jaguar seem to be occurring. Okay. And for each cluster, one of the interesting questions is, since there is no obvious ground truth, when the search engine finds clusters, it is important for them to describe the cluster to the user. Okay, so it's not enough to just say here are the normal results, here are the clusters. And notice what they did here. Each cluster is described by a couple of words that seem to be occurring frequently in that cluster. Okay, in fact, that's a very nice problem. You know, if you're doing it in the project 3, let's say, if you were to do clustering on top of a search engine, it's not enough to find just the clusters. Okay, you've already found that project part 1, you just got the URLs. And, you know, most of you just printed out the URLs for each answer. Okay, that's, you know, that, you know, it might be good enough for a project, but it's useless if, as far as the user is concerned, because how the heck do they know which URL actually is relevant to them? You need to give them an explanation as to why they should click on that. The explanation for search engines is what? Synopsis, page synopsis. If you basically give some words that occur around the keywords that you are searching for, and that becomes the page synopsis. And if you like the page synopsis, then you click on it. Saying you click in everything and then find out which one is relevant is not as useful. Okay? And the same synopsis there for normal pages, it becomes descriptions of clusters. And there's actually an interesting sub-problem here, as if you were to find clusters, what would be the few things you would say to describe this group of things? If you are into text, so if I say this is a group, this is a group, how do I describe these groups? Right? So if I were to say this is mostly graduate students, this is mostly undergraduate students, this is mostly people who are awake, these are mostly people who are sleeping, something I have to come up with. Then you will decide which group you like more. Right? So these groups, so for text, you can actually do this in terms of term frequencies. Look for frequently occurring terms. As long as I'm talking about it, give me a slightly better idea. I just said, for each cluster, you will suppose take the top 5 terms that seem to be occurring most frequently in the subset of documents in that cluster. Can you give me a better idea? How do you do that?
Do a vector similarity
No, so basically remember in the normal vector space, we not only took TF, but you took, TF always goes with what else? IDF, right? So IDF is, so I have not, it's not enough to just say I have a whole bunch of these, but nobody else has these. That's what IDF was. That's what IDF was, right? Now how would you do that for this? How would you do this for clustering? You need a version of IDF, okay, except it would be ICF, inverted clustering frequency, okay? So each cluster should give higher weightage to the terms that seem to be most frequent. This is the second time we had the streaker in our class. Okay. But this guy didn't look as sure as the first guy. The first guy just walked right in front of me. This guy was slightly worried. But anyway, so the IDF, it was across all documents, including the documents in this cluster. What you really care about is ICF. What terms that are present in this cluster are not present in any other cluster. You know the easiest way to do that? Remember, each cluster is a set of documents. Documents are bags of words. Set of documents is a big bag of words. Do you understand what I'm saying? So suppose you went to Safeway and got a bag of groceries, you went to Fry's and got another bag of groceries, you don't need to put those bags separately in a big bag, you can pour them both into a bigger bag. That's still a bag of groceries. Right? So each cluster is a bag of words. So cluster becomes a super document. And then you take the IDF across these super documents. That's a way you can actually get these descriptions. I still didn't tell you, how did you come up with the cluster? That is what mostly we will be discussing, okay? But after you come up with the clusters, you need to give the user some way of figuring out what is there in that cluster. And for text search engines, the best thing is to tell me what makes me me. I mean, tell the user what makes this cluster uniquely this cluster. It is those words that appear in this cluster that don't seem to appear anywhere else. So TF times ICF. Cute idea, right? Okay, so you could do that, and then presumably based on this, the users might say, well, I'm really into, you know, like Jaguar the car, so maybe I'll click on the Jaguar dealer, for example. Or there must be, I hope, a Jaguar the animal, no, zookeeper, Denver. Hopefully you will say that must be the Jaguar the animal, okay? So that's one example, you know, I mean, so that's the idea of how the clustering could be useful. So that's clustering, one more example. Here are, what is this, one more, this was Northern Light. I don't know whether Northern Light exists anymore. Those of you who are peering and checking something else on the laptops instead can check this and you'll get class credit for one. So to see whether northernlight.com exists, I think it does still. Although nobody is really using it. This clustering is actually quite interesting. It doesn't exist anymore. It was a prototype search engine, okay? And this was used, this basically to do this, what they did was they did latent semantic indexing and then found clusters. And again, I'll talk to you in a minute about the background in clustering, but one issue is we'll realize eventually some things fall into a group because they are somehow closer to each other than they are to the other group. Right, that's how you make clusters. Closer, farther, they are distance measures. So to define clustering, you need a distance measure. The way I define the distance measure changes the clustering, first of all. And furthermore, anything that improves distance estimation improves clustering. One issue we talked about is we said similarity measurement is a distance. Similarity between two documents is inverse of the distance. Right? Okay. And you can improve similarity between documents by taking latent semantic indexing, which will reduce the dimensionality and then take the similarity between the documents. Presumably, that's because we thought that improves the distance computation. If you truly believe that, then when you are clustering these documents, then you do first latent semantic indexing and then do clustering on top. And there was this idea, I think it was, forget the name of this, Manjara. Manjara is this search engine which essentially did this. It will come up with the top 100 or top 1000 results. It actually won't even have a search engine running. They'll just take top 1000 results by calling a bunch of other search engines and taking their, you know, 100 from each guy. Okay? And then do a quick latent semantic indexing while the user waits. Okay? And then do a clustering on top. They'll do a k-means clustering, for example. Okay, we'll talk about k-means clustering. Some of you probably already know, but we'll still talk about it here. Okay? And then, now the interesting question is, in doing so, they needed to do latent semantic indexing while the users are waiting, while the users are waiting. And we know that latent semantic indexing is a cubic time operation, right? Even though you're talking, doing it only on 1,000 documents, it's still, you know, large amount of vocabulary. Documents, just because you reduce the documents, that doesn't mean the vocabulary reduces. Okay, so one of the things they did actually is they came up with approximation algorithms for SVD computation. I mentioned this when we were talking about latent semantic indexing. That's another example of using clusters. Okay, that's another search engine. But these guys just put it up as a prototype and, you know, didn't really make much money. You know, they both, the guy who did this work is Ravi Kannan, and, you know, he's a theoretician. You know, probably this is the only program that he ever wrote. But it's a nice one. So those are examples of clustering over the search engines. And then and those examples also tell you, for example, that clustering can be done at the indexing time itself. If you want, you can actually find clusters at the time of indexing, or you can also do them at the query time. Okay, the examples I showed you are all doing it at the query time. That means you get the query, you get 1,000 results, and then find clusters among them. Okay, you can apply the clustering to documents. You can also apply it to snippets. If all you have in front of you are snippets, so in fact you can apply it to the snippets and see which snippets seem to be, you know, about a particular thing. So for example, one thing you can do is you could take Google's results, and then instead of getting all the documents, you can just do clustering on the snippets, for example. Okay, the clustering of course depends on the distance measure you describe between the entities. You can define distances in terms of URLs, and so basically the link connection. How far is this term from this term? Okay, if you're trying to find cliques in high school, right, I won't look at what people are doing, I look at who they know, and then that's how clique is defined. It's in the social network. So the clusters in the social network. I can define it in terms of the text content, for example, which is what we've been talking about all this while. So you have all these possible uses for clustering in the text search engine. And so what I'm going to do for the next 15 minutes and again next class is what you can, you know, basically some of the basic algorithms in clustering. In particular, I'm going to look at k-means and hierarchical clustering because they are actually reasonably useful for text search. Okay. Again, as I said, clustering is a whole topic by itself, and there's a lot of work being currently done too, but this is one place where we are looking into text mining. This is unsupervised text mining. Okay, so here are clusters. Here is an example of, you know, points. How many clusters are there? So apparently already people start seeing different. This is like a Rorschach test. You know, I show you an ink plot and say, what is there in this, right? So how many clusters are there? Some people thought two, some people thought three. Some people actually are finding 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Everybody is unique. What do you mean you want to group me with somebody else, right? Right. So the point I'm making is, even if I put all the entities into some metric space, which is already a huge, big step. Okay, for example, if I were to take you, and I'm trying to, you know, cluster you guys, okay, first I have to put you in a metric space. You are all XY coordinates in this space. What X and what Y? That in itself is a huge, big judgment I make. For example, I say, I'm going to cluster you based on your hair length and, you know, whether or not, and your nail length. Okay, then I will get a cluster. It may not be the cluster that is of use to anybody. Okay, so but that's after that is already decided, that's basically called the feature engineering in all of machine learning. Which features are you supposed to even consider? In the case of documents, you could make the reasonable assumption that all the words in the document somehow is the universe of features of interest. So then each document becomes a point in n-dimensional space with each dimension being a keyword, each dimension being a term. Okay? And you have these n-dimensional, in the n-dimensional space you have points, and you're trying to find, you know, which points seem to be clustered together. Okay? So the issue in this case is in trying to decide whether there are one, I mean, even after putting it in the metric space, first of all I need to answer, before you can decide how many clusters are there, you need to ask, are there hard or soft clusters? Hard clusters means nobody can be in two different groups. Each entity has to be in a different group. So that means clustering is a partition. Soft clusters basically means people can be in multiple groups, multiple clusters. Okay, I have to decide that. I have also to decide the distance measure. In fact, before I even came to this, I have actually decided the space. What are the dimensions of the space in which I'm putting these entities as points? That is actually the biggest decision people make in before they even start doing clustering. Okay, but even after doing that, the question is, here, are you going to take Euclidean distance? Are you going to take dot product distance? Are you going to take basically dot product distance is also the cosine similarity distance. Those are all choices. Okay. The other thing is, even if I tell you what the distances are, even what the distance metric you are supposed to use is, or you decided that I'm going to use cosine theta similarity metric, then the question then is, exactly how am I going to decide that one clustering is better than another clustering? And that brings us to this internal versus external measures. I'll get that in a minute, okay? Because if there is a ground truth, then the guy who wins is the one who gets the right clusters. If there is no ground truth, which is most of the case, then the guy who wins is the guy who writes the answers clearly. Okay, that means these guys' clusters are nice and round compared to somebody else's clusters. Even if, in fact, this is a wrong space, this is a wrong distance metric, and but you got nice spherical clusters. That's what people like. Okay, so we will talk about that issue of cluster quality, internal measures. For the internal measures, what you look at is how close are things within the cluster. That's the intra-cluster closeness. The other is how far is each cluster from the other clusters. That's the inter-cluster distance. And if you are just thinking, this is, I mean, again, to belabor my example, if you didn't know, suppose I gave you a bunch of problems for midterm, not that I would like to do that, but suppose I give you a bunch of problems for the midterm for which I don't know the answers. By the way, that's exactly what research is all about. When you're done with this class and when you start writing papers, nobody knows whether the paper you wrote is useful paper to write or not. What we figure out is collectively we figure out the bad papers will fall apart, good papers will help us do something else. Okay? So now when you send a paper to conference, right, there is an internal measure of quality. Did the guy write large number of grammatical errors in the paper? Okay? If they do that, I'm telling you, your paper will get rejected because people don't even want to read badly written paper. Did they overuse the page length restrictions, that is, somebody said write a 6-page paper and this guy uses 4-point size font and doesn't leave any margins so that they can say everything plus more, right? And then are they surprised that the paper doesn't get through? Why? Because somebody threw the paper out based on the internal measure of quality. It doesn't even look good. Okay, the other one is the external measure of quality. Is this paper going to change the ages? Nobody knows the answer to that. If I can, probably I can write such papers too. Okay, every reviewer likes to say that they can predict whether or not some paper will change the world. Okay, but nobody really can answer that question. So mostly you would take an internal measure and an external measure. And internal measure, if you screw up, if you write badly, your paper is out. If you write well, paper with not too much ideas might actually get through, unfortunately. Okay, and the same thing for the exam. So if I were to give you a set of questions for which I don't know the answers, I have no clue whether your answers are right or wrong. And this guy wrote everything in one page, small letters, and even my, you know, old people glasses are not helpful. And this other guy wrote really big letters and in beautiful color, proper margins. I say, you know, who the heck knows what's the right answer, but this guy's at least I can read. Give him extra 5 points. Okay, so internal quality measures are how close is the cluster within itself and how far is each cluster from the other cluster. External quality measures are if I happen to know beforehand how many classes are there and what the classes are, then I can check whether you actually did the class classification correctly. And for the IR, what is the measures we use? Precision and recall measures, right? Precision and recall measures are possible because they are internal or external measures. Come on, guys. External measures, because these you can only do precision and recall if you know what are the relevant documents. Imagine a search engine saying everything I put in the top 10 is relevant. Then by definition, that search engine has 100% precision. And it can make one more assumption saying everything useful I put in the first page itself, then in which case it also has 100% recall. Okay, so for clustering, the question is to do it in terms of doing external measures, I need to know the classes before. Normally, you don't expect that to be possible. If it is possible, then you can do a precision recall style measurement for clusters too. Mostly what you would concentrate on as the internal measures, which is how close are the clusters to each other within themselves and how far they are from each other. Now the interesting question is formalizing those two questions is still complicated. Okay, so suppose I have a cluster like this. How do I decide whether this cluster is close, in every point in this cluster is close to each other or not? Do I, for example, consider all pairwise distances between every pair of points and take the average of that? Or do I take the centroid and take the distance from the centroid to each point and then take the average of that? Do I take the diameter of the cluster, the two farthest entities in the cluster, and say that tells me how close close-knit the cluster is? These are different ways of judging intra-cluster closeness, and they will give me different kinds of clusters. What's more interesting is that's just for within the cluster. Now I'm talking about how far is this cluster from this cluster? How do I define that? Am I going to take pairs in one here, and take their average distances and their distances and take the average over all these pairs and say that is the distance between the clusters? Or do I take the closest two points in each of these clusters and say how far they are? Okay? Now, you might think these are obviously kind of theoretical questions with no real impact on your life. Okay, so here is a way of thinking about it. Suppose a bunch of, you know, I did the midterm and I decided to give you letter grades right after the midterm. Grades means clusters, right? You understand that. Because if I don't want to, you know, I give you grades, each person has separate mark. You can have 97.8358, which is uniquely different from 97.8359. Okay, the moment I do grades, I'm clustering you guys into groups. And I get into trouble all the time. Right after the grades, people come and argue, saying, you know, I need to be in a different group. I don't like the losers I'm stuck with. I'm much better off with this other group. So here are the marks. I put them in the sorted order, let's say. My question, normally what happens is, you know, I'll get divine intervention right before the, you know, final day, and I'll say, wow, this is a good clustering. I'm not allowed, unfortunately, by university rules to do soft clustering, which means I give you an A grade as well as a B grade. Although A plus and B minus are sort of like that, but, you know, normally I have to give each of you a grade. Okay? So now the question is, I'm clustering these one-dimensional data. you know, pardon the pun, but you know, your cumulative score is your one-dimensional data. First of all, you guys think they are different numbers, but we weight them all together, we come at cumulative score, and I'm trying to decide who gets A, who gets B, who gets C. Right? So what do I think of? I would probably, so most of the time what happens is people come and say, this person will come and say, come on, I'm so close to this cluster. How can I not be in this cluster? You know, why can't you make A a little bigger so that I can be in the A and these losers can be in the later grade? What inter-cluster distance measure are they using? They're looking at the distance between the two closest points in the cluster. Two closest points in the cluster. And then I look at them and say, yeah, you are close to this guy, but do you realize how far you are from that guy? That guy has 110 out of 100, and you are 57. So if you want to count that, I want to count this. That's a different distance. Okay? Or I can actually say, well, I'm actually looking at centroid distances, and that's a different distance. This one, by the way, this is called single link distance. We'll talk about this. There's a technical term for this. It's called single link distance. And if you do single link distance based inter-cluster distances, then you get clusters which are nice and thin like chains. The other place where single link distances are used are when people cross red lights. Right? Because they cross because the other guy crossed, and so I'm right close to this guy, so I get to cross too. So how many of times did you guys see, you know, there will be like a green arrow which became non-green arrow and you have a green, but there's like a whole sequence of cars which thinks as if it's like a train and it's going through. Why? Because they're no longer interested in how far away from the light change time they were. I'm close to the next guy, that guy is crossing, so I should be allowed to cross. And many a time like a train of them cross, and then all this oncoming traffic waits for like 3 or 4 extra seconds and then moves. That's single link clustering. Okay? A complete link clustering would basically take the distances between all pairs and decide how far each of the cluster is from the other cluster. The point is, I did not even get to an algorithm yet. And I'm already basically pointing out to you that the importance of distance, the importance of deciding closeness of a cluster, tightness of a cluster, and the importance of deciding how far each cluster is, and the fact that there is ambiguity in each of these. I can define distances differently by changing the coordinates. I can, even if I decided on the coordinates, I can change the notion of closeness by considering centroid distance versus pairwise distance. And even after that, I can decide, change the notion of inter-cluster distance. Okay, and based on these, I will wind up getting different kinds of clusters. Okay, so now if I can get all kinds of clusters, then as I said, how do I evaluate which cluster is better? So as I said, there are two ways of doing it, and we'll probably talk a little about this and come back to it next class. One is internal, which is intra-cluster and inter-cluster distance. The other is external measures. For the intra-cluster, basically what I just discussed all this while was that issue, which is, do you consider all pairs of points? You want to take between the centroid and other points? Or do you take the distance between the outliers of the cluster, which is the diameter of the cluster? And for the inter-cluster distance, do you take the distances between the centroids? Do you take the distances between all pairs? Do you take the distance between the closest two guys? Do you take the distance between the farthest two guys? Based on how you decide this, you will wind up getting different kinds of clusters. Okay, this much is for sure though. If I were to define intra-cluster distance and inter-cluster distance, then the quality of a clustering is a function of both these. Right? What the best clustering should have very low intra-cluster distance and very high inter-cluster distance. Just like, as I said, you know, basically it's two dimensions and both are important. Okay, so a best flight, air travel should have cheap cost and fast time. You won't get it. Many a time you have to compare one which is cheaper but takes more time and one which is costlier and takes less time. And that's why you have a function which combines those two. And the way you combine them winds up changing what you decide is the best cluster. Okay, one interesting way it turns out you can do this is to decide the number of clusters upfront. If I decide the number of clusters upfront, then to some extent it winds up being, you know, the function becomes easier to specify. K-means winds up doing that. In the case of K-means, you decide the number of clusters upfront. So not only do you have the data, but you are also told there's only these many clusters. For grading, for letter grades, university made my life easy, right? Because they told me how many clusters are there. There are A plus, A minus, B plus, B, B minus, C plus, C, no C minus, and D. Those are the clusters, and then E, of course, fail. So, you know, grading is a K-means clustering. That sort of reduces some of the difficulty of deciding how much importance for intra-cluster distance and how much for inter-cluster distance. Okay, the last thing, essentially, which I'll have to come back to it next time anyway, is external measures. And the external measures, really, if I happen to know, suppose, and I'll just talk about this picture, suppose it turns out that you are blind, you know, the clustering engine is blind, and color blind, okay? And really, the clusters I have in mind are a blue cluster, a green cluster, and a red cluster. I, the teacher, have in mind. Then you clustered them like this. Then from an external point of view, you got all mixed clusters, right? You didn't have all reds here. They're all red, but one blue here. This one is mostly blue, one red and one green. This one is two reds and three greens. It doesn't matter to me if you, as long as you got each cluster to be one single color, it wouldn't have mattered to me whether this was all red and this was all green, or this was all green and this was all red. What matters to me is the purity of your cluster. You didn't combine apples and oranges. You unfortunately are fruit challenged. You don't even know what are apples and what are oranges. And you are making them into clusters based on some nonsensical measure such as roundness or something. Then I get to look at your clustering and say, hey, you have this particular pail has 100 apples and 3 oranges. This one has 300 oranges and 5 apples. Neither of them are good clusters. But they're close to being pure. Because this one is like 3 over 103 pure. I mean, 100 over 103 pure. Okay? And so what I would do in this particular case is the cluster purity for this would be 5 over 6 for this. And similarly, cluster purity for this, you take the majority and assume that's what you wanted this to be. Okay? So the cluster purity for this would be 4 over 6. The cluster purity for this would be 3 over 5. And the total goodness of this clustering is the weighted sum of these clusters, purities. And the weighting matters because I basically want to say it should be 6 times the purity of this plus 6 times the purity of this plus 5 times the purity of this divided by 6 plus 6 plus 5. That way I would not give you too many points because you have one cluster which has only one guy. So obviously that will be 100% pure. Do you understand what I'm saying? Right? If somebody wound up making 4 clusters, you know, where 3 clusters are one individual each, so they are 100% pure. And the fourth cluster contains everybody, rest of everybody. That's not a good clustering. And you can handle that by taking the weighting. Okay? When we come back, we'll also look at another measure called RAND index, which actually is closer to precision and recall. You know, you can look at this, and in fact, you'll see that this is connected to IR ideas. The question of how many same cluster things got separated, how many non-same cluster things got connected. And those become precision and recall issues. Okay? And then we'll also look at some classical clustering ideas.